From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Can knowledge of nature provide guidance for how we are to live? In a forthcoming study about biology and human ethics, that question is central for one scholar and physician who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Leon Cass of the University of Chicago spent a year at the center investigating the connections among biology, philosophy, and the ethics of food and eating. Leon Cass is the author of many publications about the ethical and social dimensions of biomedical research and practice. His latest book is Toward a More Natural Science, Biology and Human Affairs, published this year by the Free Press. Leon Cass, let's begin our conversation about your project at the Humanities Center. You're a physician at the University of Chicago. You're also strongly interested in bioethics. And your project at the center deals with the relationships among eating and nature, the larger world that we inhabit, mm-hmm. and ethical questions about those connections. This is a very big project. Can you sort of sketch for me the broad outline?
Well, it is a very large project, and maybe the way to begin to talk about it is to step back from the project itself and give some kind of indication of what has led me to this inquiry, if I might. I have for a long time been concerned about the gap between the world as modern science has come to understand it and the world as we experience it in ordinary life. Mm-hmm. This has been characterized as the gap between the so-called two cultures, and it has been a concern of many people for a long time. At the beginning of modern science, the philosophers of modern science, I mean people like Bacon and Descartes, decided deliberately to turn their back on ordinary experience, on the world of appearances, on the world colored by our opinions born out of that experience.
What they were looking for was empirical, provable, replicable fact. Is that right?
Well, empirical is a funny word because empirical really means based upon experience. And so
you have a contradiction right there.
Yeah, that there is a new understanding of what empirical means. Uh-huh. It's not empirical based upon the ordinary experience of the world, but on new kinds of experiences that come out of experiment. Mm-hmm. What I'm looking for, mm-hmm. Just to summarize this early part, I'm looking for a richer and what I call a more natural biology, uh-huh. one which does which doesn't dismiss and ignore the very real phenomena of living organisms and of ourself as very special organisms. One of the dominant modes of biology is to analyze wholes in terms of parts, mm-hmm. and to explain the activities of organisms in terms of the motions of their smallest elements and mm-hmm. parts. A shorthand for what this might mean with respect to eating and metabolism would be to say that finally the forms and activities and doings of complicated organisms are finally to be understood in terms of the structure and motions of the smallest material parts. In other words, that we are what we eat. That mm-hmm. is, that's a certain slogan for a corporealist or materialist understanding of life. Mm-hmm. And part of my intent in this project is to call this assumption into question and to provide some evidence that it is mistaken, I mean, to put it bluntly. Uh-huh. Now, if it were the case that one could show that modern science is not so much wrong about nature, but incomplete, and that there is a kind of teaching, at least about living nature, which would enable us to have a richer and fuller view of organisms, That fuller view of living nature and of ourselves within it might turn out not only not to be hostile to our ethical concerns, but might indeed point us in a fuller direction. Please.
Leon Cass, your topic is eating and nature and biology. Help me now. Let's isolate one aspect of this very large project that you are investigating at the Humanities Center. How would you look for this other view, this alternative view?
All right.
Lead me into that.
Okay. Well, the first part of this project is, in fact, the ground for this new view. I tried to elaborate a theory of organism. Mm-hmm. It's a bit too grandiose, but an understanding of organism in which we do not reduce the whole to its parts, but we come to understand that each level of organization has to be understood as organized. That is, I'm arguing once again for the primacy of form in relation to its own material.
Mm-hmm. And you don't want to reduce it simply to a bunch of atoms swirling around.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You are, again, the key word here would be organization.
Organization, form.
Uh-huh.
And I think eating turns out to be a nice model for this. Partly because metabolism has been one of the great strongholds of biochemical analysis, and we've done wonderful things biochemically in understanding all of the individual chemical reactions that make up the turnover of food. Mm-hmm. If one could show that one needs notions of form and organization even to understand this mindless activity of metabolism, then all the more so for absolutely everything else biological.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one begins with the following kinds of thoughts. Almost every molecule of the living body, of all organisms, not just the human organism, turns over and is exchanged. Nevertheless, something persists, which is one and the same organism. It is alive precisely because of this turnover. Now, what is it that persists? What persists is a certain kind of organization of parts.
You remind me, Leon Cass, of that. Is it William Butler Yeats? How do you figure out the difference between the dancer,
the dancer and the dance? Well, I come to that in a way, because the notion of form that I have is not a mere static notion,
right,
of shape or structure, but in fact what is decisive in what persists. Are certain kinds of powers and activities.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the thing that persists is a certain organization among whose essential powers is the power to keep the organization persisting.
Mm-hmm. To survive.
To survive. Mm-hmm. And not only to survive, I think, as one could show as one moves up the evolutionary scale.
Uh-huh.
It's an intermediate step that's needed. So, the organism is, in a way, independent of its materials. Nevertheless, it's absolutely dependent upon the continuous provision of materials.
Now, when you say materials, you're talking about food.
Food.
Yeah.
Food.
The things that we eat to stay alive.
And in order to get these materials, we need to have a relation with the outside world different from the relation of any inanimate thing.
Mm-hmm.
That is, we need... out there is stuff of importance to us, and therefore we have an openness to the world denied to inanimate objects. That openness is an openness both for action, but also of receptivity and awareness.
We have a need for the world.
That's very nice. It's not merely, as the behaviorists will say, to be understood in terms of input and output, stimulus and response. The whole outward movement of the organism into the world is grounded in neediness,
mm-hmm,
in appetition, in desire. So with the emergence of life, even at its lowest forms, and well before there is consciousness, one really has a new kind of world relation, one that is receptive and makes discriminations in what's out there, one that is capable of acting on the world, and one that is finally driven by a certain rudimentary impulse or desire for which survival is in a way, the goal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these new powers in the world of awareness and motion and desire, which are in the service of survival, become gradually complexified as one goes up the evolutionary scale, and they acquire, so to speak, a life of their own. They become activities gradually and increasingly separated from the goal of survival.
I mean, is this where ethics enters into the kinds of the ways we think about this need that we have for the world and the way we deal with it?
Well, the largest aspect of ethics really emerges only when you have relationships with other beings and especially with other human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a concrete example. Compare the different relations between the following organisms and their nourishment. An extreme case would be a plant. A plant seeks nutriments from the soil, and the nutriments that it gets are very close at hand. That as they are up against the surface of the plant, so they are, admittedly selectively, but immediately moved across the boundary. If one moves to mammals, food is to be pursued across a gap of distance.
Mm-hmm. It's not so close.
It's not so close. In fact, one could make an argument that whereas a plant has a much more immediate relation to its environment, the animal lives mediatedly,
mm-hmm.
Across some gap toward all of the things that are relevant for it.
Sure, it has a spatial dimension, for instance, that the plant would not experience.
Right, a spatial distance and also a temporal one.
Yeah.
That is, if you take a fox chasing a rabbit,
sure.
The rabbit is over there and not yet. And what the fox wants is that the rabbit should be here and now.
Okay? Right.
And that opens up a gap between activity and satisfaction of hunger. Which activity acquires pleasures and delights in its own right?
Mm-hmm.
That is, that there are pleasures of the chase as well as pleasures of devouring.
Uh-huh.
And these new powers of world relation, powers of motion, powers of reception and awareness, powers of appetite, these new things become part of the life of the animal and not merely instruments of preservation.
And they also bear, these elements bear on the way the animal thinks about the world it inhabits and the things that it pursues and the things that it needs to survive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
do you call this ethics?
Well, I call this so far just a kind of richer view of the life of organisms.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what among the things that we would have to fill in some gaps, but I need to add one further thought. One of the things about eating, which makes it already problematic even before we come to ethics before we come to human life, is the following. The living world is articulated into a variety of forms, each of which is engaged in activities to keep that particular form in being.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that, at least for most organisms, its own preservation depends absolutely on its ability to deform and destroy other living forms. That is, life is this paradoxical thing which, in order to keep itself going, has almost always, except with respect to the photosynthetic beings,
has to
consume other life.
Yeah.
And therefore, life is that intrusion into the world of something which is in principle capable of destroying the world. And I don't even, this is before you get to man and his tremendous new capacities for destruction.
Yeah.
Life is destabilizing by its very nature, and eating is that activity in which you see this contradiction of life. Now, if eating is already the homogenization of other forms to turn them into yourself, then omnivorousness, that is, the capacity to eat everything, is a certain bodily mark of a being whose standing in the world is problematic, to say the least.
Are you talking about humankind?
Well, I'm talking most especially about humankind. That is, human beings are the ultimate eaters, because there is nothing that they cannot eat. I don't mean nothing, but that they eat. They eat. They are really the ultimate omnivores.
Well, they have a greater power of selection, and they have more power over the world around them.
Right, and that is, as it were, not just a matter of conscious choice, although that enters in, to be sure, but it's written even in our teeth. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is, we have unspecialized dentition. We share with the herbivores the grinding teeth, with the carnivores somewhat reduced canine teeth, with the rodents the incisors, and as it were, all forms of specialized life we have preserved in an unspecialized way. Mm-hmm. Now, I take it that this bodily mark of our flexibility is a certain unpremeditated sign of the problem of man as the potential tyrant in the world, for whom everything is potentially at his disposal for his use. Mm-hmm. And the need for ethics is somehow can be seen in the fact of human omnivorousness. That is, to put it in an overly lurid way, and I hope you'll forgive me, one could say that when one encounters another being in the world, it is always a question as to what you should do with him, and in the extreme case, whether he's fit to be eaten.
Uh-huh. And or used or consumed.
Or used in some way.
Right.
Right. And eating would be an ultimate kind of exploitation.
Uh-huh.
And in a way, one of the striking, if one moved from the sort of phenomenological discussion of eating to the ethical guidelines for the governance of eating, one is struck by the fact that almost all cultures have customs regarding hospitality and a strong taboo on cannibalism.
Right.
Now, they don't bother to explain why there's a taboo on cannibalism, and one should be reluctant, I think, to try to rationalize what is, I think, a very deep-seated repugnance in human beings.
Well, it's fairly self-evident, but what you mentioned a moment ago, this need to consume the world, that may be self-evident. But what is not self-evident is the intrinsic ability to control that need.
Exactly.
And again, I throw this word ethics into the conversation.
Yeah, it does seem to me that somewhere in the primordial human consciousness, if we go back historically, is the recognition that man is by nature capable of being both the best and the worst of the animals, that his latitude is a gift of great promise as well as great danger, and that everything depends upon how those capacities are shaped, harnessed, trained as to whether he becomes best or worst.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about biology and ethics. My guest is a physician and scholar from the University of Chicago who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Leon Cass is the author of a forthcoming study entitled From Nature to Ethics, an examination of the biomedical, social, and ethical dimensions of food and eating. Leon Cass's most recent book is Toward a More Natural Science, Biology and Human Affairs, published this year by the Free Press. Here is Leon Cass.
There's a wonderful passage in Aristotle's Politics in which Aristotle says, exactly in the place where he celebrates man as the animal having speech, that separated from law and justice, he's the worst of the animals, especially regarding sex and eating. He doesn't say what he means. I mean, I have suspicions that he means things like incest and cannibalism, and gluttony. And the beginnings of human ethics, I think, rests upon the recognition, A, of the need for restraint of appetite. That, in other words, it was broadly speaking, the restraint of appetite is the beginning of civilization. Toilet training, and the limitation of what's edible and how you eat.
Mm-hmm.
So the taboo against cannibalism is a certain recognition of the common humanity of you and the other. Mm-hmm. That means the stranger is different from the other potentially edibles.
Uh-huh.
And that although he might be my enemy for all kinds of other reasons, when he shows up on my doorstep, a good community, however parochial it might be in other respects, would acknowledge the common humanity of the other. It's somehow unblinkable. You can't miss it.
Mm-hmm.
Let me choose a slightly different example.
Okay.
I mean, it's been on my mind some to talk about, to think about two things that are common in our culture. One is food processing.
Uh-huh.
Now, admittedly, it's a tremendous labor-saving device, and we have one in my home, so I this is not holier than thou. On the other hand, there is a tendency in food processing to homogenize foods and turn eating into flavor. There is a German proverb to the effect that the peasant eats only what he knows. And it is said by the enlightened and upper classes in a tone of disparagement about the poor peasant who doesn't somehow know the refined things of high cuisine.
Leon, are you talking about the difference between flavor and nutriment?
No, I'm talking about, well, there are missing links in the argument, but let me try to get at it this way. When you homogenize your food, and you in a way you destroy all recognition that in eating you're in fact eating some being,
mm-hmm.
that some being's life has been given up for the sake of the preservation of yours or for your palate, what have you.
And now we're back to the question of forms and appearance.
Exactly. And what I was saying is that I think there's something to be said for never forgetting the paradoxical nature of life's need to sustain itself, never forgetting that food is in a way that your eating comes at the cost of some other life. And I don't mean to sentimentalize it. I mean, it does seem that whether it be other animals or other even vegetables, that a living thing is being sacrificed for the sake of your own preservation or delight.
Well,
that is hidden from view mm-hmm. when you homogenize shape and you can no longer see that it is in fact a chicken that has been eaten. That is, we have somehow processed things in such a way that we are really left only with the taste, and it is somehow increasingly hidden from view that that we're eating organisms.
You're not indulging in a sort of food chain nostalgia here, are you?
No, I don't think so. I mean, take the fact that human beings don't simply feed, but they ritualize the activity of eating through dining or eating at table.
Utensils,
an order of the meal,
right.
Seated eating in company.
Well, Dr. Swift had some interesting things. Dean Swift had some interesting ways of satirizing all of that formality and pretense. But
well, I don't think it's simply pretense. I mean, you could say, look, what we're doing is hiding from ourselves
our animal nature.
Our mere animal nature.
Right.
On the other hand, one could say, and I think one would say more truly if one said, one is using our animal necessities as occasions to show that we are not merely animal. That is, that these provide these provide the opportunities for dignification.
Civilizing ourselves.
Yeah. And in fact, you mentioned before Yeats's line about the dancer and the dance.
Uh-huh.
There would be no dancing if there were no gravity. Right? And there would be no refinement if there were no necessity that somehow mm-hmm. called for refinement.
Right.
And one wonders about these kinds of habits of acculturation if eating comes more and more to be regarded as fueling, which it seems to me is part of the fast food business. I mean, I don't disparage for a moment its convenience, mm-hmm. and one makes use of it from time to time. But the question is, What would we think, or what should we think, if one moved toward that day in the future satirized by Charlie Chaplin in Modern Times, where, as it were, you have feeding machines, that as we now have water in the tap, we have 50,000 flavors fed us from some kind of central place. Yeah. We would still be fueled.
Yeah.
We might even still have the same tastes. Mm-hmm. But I think one could argue that the whole meaning of being self-conscious, semi-autonomous, but nevertheless dependent and needy beings would have vanished. That somehow is embodied in what we have done to civilize and ritualize the meal.
Aldous Huxley had some of that in mind, too, I think. Leon Cass, let's conclude our conversation. Would you think of yourself as an optimist in your view of this very complex relationship among and between eating and nature and ethics? Are you suggesting here a sort of logic of necessity, that because we have to go through these rituals of eating and consuming the world, that we're going to get to be better men and women?
No, I think I'm generally accused of being a pessimist and being doubtful about where technology is taking us, that we've lost touch with many of the fundamental notions and truths of human life, and scramble off after satisfactions and so on. That's usually what I'm accused of. My experience, however, in speaking about some of these things would lead me to think that, never mind our practice for a moment, at least with respect to our thought, people need more to be reminded than instructed. Mm. That is, when one talks about these things, people recognize immediately what you're talking about.
A sort of quietness falls over your audience, is that right?
That I don't say anything that I think is especially original. I've never aspired to being original. I think if I had to characterize what I'm trying to do, it's to rediscover, or at least to make a matter of public speech again, certain things that the human race has long known and probably still knows somewhere buried away, to somehow see the profundity in the obvious, which, if we'd pause for a minute, we could again make part of our life. And I certainly, amongst my students and people who have discussed my public lectures on eating and other topics, I have a certain sense that there's reason at least for some guarded hope with respect to the future.
Leon Cass is a physician and scholar at the University of Chicago. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Leon Cass worked on a forthcoming study about the biomedical, social, and ethical dimensions of food and eating. Leon Cass's most recent book is Toward a More Natural Science, Biology and Human Affairs, published this year by the Free Press. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Leon Cass on biology and ethics, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, conversations about agriculture and American history, and about the anthropology of hunting in the American South. The Soundings panelists will include scholars from Davidson College, Northwestern University, and the University of Florida. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for a conversation about biology and human ethics. Can knowledge of nature provide guidance for how we should live? To what extent does biomedical research yield reliable social yardsticks regarding the relationships among food, eating, and culture? Listen for some answers and insights from Leon Cass, a physician and scholar from the University of Chicago. From Nature to Ethics, Biology and Philosophy, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.